Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. Today is Horticulture Day. I'm Charity Nebbe. Over the next few weeks, Iowa will be transformed by new growth. It is an exciting time of year, but it's also a busy time of year in the yard and garden. Right now, we're going to focus on the yard. Adam Tomes is an assistant professor of horticulture at Iowa State University and ISU Extension turf grass specialist. Hello, Adam.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. And all right, it's not quite time to go out and work on the yard, but if you have a turf grass lawn, there are things you should be planning for, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we're still 2 weeks away, I would say, from when we can really get out and get in the yard. Right now, things are still too cold. So, you know, you can start to get your fertilizer lined up for the spring, but don't spread it quite yet. Your pre-emerge as well, you're just a little bit too early. So just start thinking about that. Maybe get your mower out and start it, see if it'll start after the winter. And that would be a good starting point.
All right. And how do you know when it's time to fertilize, if you fertilize?
Yeah. You know, if you're going to fertilize, you're going to want to look at soil temps and see, you know, if they're in the 50s. The other thing is check your ground. You can just take a screwdriver and push it in the ground. If the ground's still frozen, then obviously the fertilizer's just going to run off. So that's why you don't want to do it quite yet.
All right. And pre-emergence this time of year, or in a few weeks, we're thinking mostly about crabgrass?
Yeah, pre-emergence would go out, you know, in 2 weeks would be the window really to start that. And we would do that to prevent crabgrass. Obviously, if you can prevent it, that's a great starting point to keep it from taking over your yard.
How do you know when it's time to start mowing?
Yeah, so, you know, you have a mower height and you never want to remove more than one third of the grass blade at a time. So if you keep your yard at 2 inches, when it gets to 3, then you know it's time to start mowing.
A lot of people want to plant grass seed this time of year, and I know exactly what you're going to tell me, but let's talk about it anyway. If I want to seed my lawn, can I do it now?
Definitely don't do it right now. You're basically going to be feeding the birds because it's way too cold. So it won't germinate right now. And so we'd say, you know, wait. The ideal time of the year, like we always say, is the fall. And so, you know, if you have to seed a yard or something like that in the spring, wait till it's at least 50 degrees. And the other thing to keep in mind is if you put out something to prevent crabgrass, don't put out grass seed because it's going to prevent that from germinating as well.
All right. Pre-emergence. Prevent emergence, right?
Exactly.
All right. So a lot of people are moving away from the traditional turf grass lawns, are trying to create lawns that are more pollinator friendly. We know that No Mow May was a huge movement, and it really seemed to catch on in an even bigger way last year. You are more in favor of a mow less May. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so, you know, No Mow May was a concept that was there to allow plants to grow up and flower and provide, you know, habitat for, you know, insects and other animals about, and also provide, you know, early season blooms for bees and other pollinators. The problem is bluegrass grows a lot during the spring, as you know, and, you know, when you let it grow for an entire month and then you try to get it back under control, that depletes the bluegrass's food reserves. And then the bluegrass dies out, or when you go to mow it back, it smothers out a lot of the pollinator plants that you want there with the clippings laying on the ground. So we would say mow less, raise your mowing height way up, and you know that still allows a lot of plants to flower underneath that mowing height, and maybe mow, you know, every 10 to 14 days as opposed to every 7 days. And you'll still have, you know, plants that will flower underneath that mowing height as well. And it won't cause the issues with the bluegrass dying. And then, you know, you could eventually end up with soil erosion and things like that if you don't have any grass there because it won't hold the soil.
Something else that we've seen is people planting a different mix of green plants on their lawn to support pollinators in a different way, a bee lawn or a bee-friendly lawn. And we just talked about how this is a bad time of year to plant grass seed unless you absolutely have to, and you know, all of the caveats. But this is a pretty good time of year to plant some of those bee-friendly plants, right?
Yeah, you're going to want to wait until, you know, you're kind of clear of that frost, because again, you don't want those plants coming up and getting hit with frost. So again, maybe wait a couple weeks, and then it's a pretty good time to do that. You know, one of the best plants for pollinators, obviously, is Dutch white clover. And so, you know, you could plant that in early April. It should come up and come in then.
For people who want to integrate that into the turf grass lawn that they may already have, how would you do that?
Yeah, so you'd want to, you know, thin out the competition. That would be one of the best ways to do it, and create, you know, more of an environment where it could come in. And so take an aerifier or a rake, rough up the ground. If you have a thin spot in your yard already, that would be a good spot to just add that seed. Just make sure that you get good seed-to-soil contact. So maybe rake away if there's dead grass or dead plant material there. Rake that away and then get that seed down in there.
All right, now I want to shift gears a little bit. Obviously, as a turf grass specialist, one of the things that you work on is turf for people who really need it. I want to talk about golf courses. A lot of golf courses just opened this week, and you have found that a lot of people who work on the turf for golf courses have been embracing more eco-friendly practices. Tell me about that.
Yeah, you know, the golf course is not the same golf course that you had in mind 10 years ago even. So they're using less nitrogen. What they found is less fertilizer makes the greens faster. And the new varieties that they use on those golf greens and fairways actually need less nitrogen. So it's more of a harder game to play because the greens are faster. So the ball rolls quicker across them. So it, you know, makes you have more skill.
Just flesh that out a little bit for me. So they're using less fertilizer that makes the greens faster because the grass isn't as thick?
It's not growing as fast.
Okay.
And so it stays shorter, and it's a firmer surface then because it produces less thatch in the ground as well. So it's a faster playing surface with the less nitrogen. And so they found that golfers actually like that better.
Oh, interesting. And you mentioned using different varieties of grass. I mean, that's an area where research is constantly being done, right?
Yeah, we're constantly evaluating here at Iowa State and the other land-grant universities across the country, you know, new varieties. So they're always coming out with more disease-resistant, more drought-resistant, and they've made great progress on that. The other thing that we've done a lot of on the research side is we look at evaluating new maintenance practices as well. So one of the most common diseases on a golf course is dollar spot. And what they found is you can actually take a roller out and roll the greens, and that helps suppress a lot of the dollar spots. So they're using less fungicide as well with their rolling practices.
They're also using more technology to understand when and how to water. I think a lot of us have that image of a golf course with the automatic watering system going off every single day. But they're being more strategic about that, right?
Yeah, they are. You know, one of the things the superintendents are doing is they're going out with these probes to check how much water is in there in the greens. And so then they know exactly how much to add back in to keep the moisture level there, to keep the plant alive. And so they're not just applying, you know, a set amount. They're recalculating that every day to add just what they need to keep that plant alive. And that's shown with a big water savings. They're using about 30% less water compared to what they were in 2005.
I can imagine that this is a real win-win scenario. I'm sure some people listening are saying, well, thank goodness, you know, golf courses are becoming more eco-friendly. But that also sounds like a money-saving approach for people who run golf courses.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a big benefit. And then, you know, that's been a big savings for them. And they've been able to put that into technology upgrades for their mowers as well. A lot of the newer mowers that you see out on the market are actually hybrid mowers or electric. And so they've been able to upgrade their mowers and be more, environmentally friendly there as well. So
the rough at some golf courses has also been transformed in recent years. Tell me about that.
Yeah, as I travel the state, Iowa has over 400 golf courses. You know, it seems like every little town has a golf course as your social spot. And they've taken a lot of the roughs and created pollinator habitat there. And, you know, the superintendents have really embraced that, and they like it. Many golf courses have bees on them as well, and so they have their own bee colonies. And some of the superintendents, they love to talk about that and how they've, you know, grown to take care of those. And
so they're really superintendents slash beekeepers?
Yes, yeah, yeah. And it's funny because they really like to talk about that almost more than the grass when I come to visit. So
interesting. Well, you, of course, are teaching the next generation of golf course superintendents. How do you see ideas shifting among your students?
Yeah, you know, the students are interested in sustainability and being good stewards of the environment. So, you know, that they get it, and they understand that things cost more as well. So they're, you know, understanding that the roughs are going to be mowed less frequently, if at all. They're going to water those less. And so they understand that, and they're, you know, concerned about that. And so, you know, we're teaching that to the next generation.
I'm sure the water technology is something that can be applied to other kinds of athletic greens as well.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the example we use is here at Iowa State. They check the football field every day for soil moisture, and then they water back to what that field needs. And that makes a better playing surface as well.
All right, but we probably won't see pollinator patches on the football field anytime soon.
No, those don't handle traffic real well, so that would create bare spots.
So how have you seen this field transform during your career? There have been a lot of changes recently.
Yeah, there has been. You know, the idea that the plants need fewer nutrient inputs has been a big one. They're more strategic about planning. The other big thing that we're seeing is, you know, if they need to do a pesticide application, they used to do it on calendar sprays. Now they're using things like growing degree days to figure out exactly when they would need to apply that, because that pest would be active at that exact moment. And so that's cut the use of pesticides as well.
Adam Tomes is an assistant professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. He's also Iowa State University Extension turf grass specialist. For more gardening information and tips, you can subscribe to our Garden Variety newsletter. Find out more at iowapublicradio.org/garden. I'm Charity Nebbe.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Adam Tomes, assistant professor of horticulture at Iowa State University and ISU Extension turfgrass specialist. Cindy Haynes is also here, professor of horticulture at ISU. Hello, Cindy.
Good morning, Charity.
And of course, you can join our conversation with your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we already have a lot of questions, so we'll dive right in. This one is from Jim in Marion County, and he's got a question for each of you. So first for you, Cindy, what is the time frame for dormant oil spraying of an apple tree?
Yeah, actually, now's a pretty good time for that. You want to do it when it's dormant. Usually we say February and March. I would kind of get this done as quickly as you possibly can. But once again, dormant oils, check the label to make sure that you're spraying for the right thing, like, you know, what it's labeled for. And we wanted you to do it before it starts to leaf out, before it starts to bloom. So pretty soon.
All right. And this one's for you, Adam. And Jim wrote this question before he listened to you in the first segment, but I think it bears repeating. He says, my lawn care company said they'd come today, March 24th, to do early spring application of fertilizer and pre-emergent herbicide. Isn't it too early?
Yeah, I would try to wait at least another week for that. So,
all right. Make a phone call.
Yep.
I'm sure they've got a busy schedule, but let's have this question now from Marlene in Ankeny. I have a cactus that is about 12 inches tall. It's leaning to one side and it looks like it needs help. It's in a 2 foot tall flat pot. Any suggestions for repotting and getting it to stand up?
Yeah, the cactus are tricky. You can repot them. When you repot them, we usually put them in slightly smaller containers. I mean, we go one size up, so you might go one size up from what it is, but it seems like a much smaller container than the top. That's because we want that kind of weight with like a terracotta or clay container. And we usually add a lot of sand or gravel to the container as well, so that it's almost 50% sand or gravel, as well as kind of potting soil. The trick is, of course, not getting poked too much by the cactus when repotting, and then trying to very gently kind of straighten it as you repot. You probably won't be 100% effective, but if you can straighten it a little bit during repotting and then kind of rotate it so that it's kind of growing towards the window, that'll help straighten it up as well. It's just a long process because cacti are really slow. Now's a good time to do it and wear really durable gloves when doing this one. And sometimes I'll even wrap a towel or something around the top of the cactus so that I can kind of handle it gently without getting a million spines in my hands.
Right. Mm-hmm. All right. Good luck with
that. Have fun.
Marlene. Anne in Cedar Rapids says, we're leaving for a 3-week trip on April 3rd. We're thinking of putting down crabgrass preventer the day before we leave. Do you think this will be too soon to be effective? I hate to ask a house sitter or a neighbor to do this for us while we're gone.
So April 2nd, looking at the weather, it should be warming up at that point. That would be a good, I think they'd be fine with that time window. The soils, it's warming quickly enough, so that would be okay.
All right. If there's snow on the ground, probably don't, right?
Don't do it. Yeah, definitely not. No.
Okay. Hopefully there won't be snow. Lynn says, my backyard, about the size of a tennis court, has 8 walnut trees in it, and the squirrels have dug up the turf, making it a muddy mess. I think I also have a fungus problem because the grass or weed turf was coming up in layers last fall. Is there any grass or rye or fescue that I could plant that would be a tough alternative to normal grass? It does get enough sun to grow most kinds of grass.
Yeah, I would consider a mix of fine fescues as well as some Kentucky bluegrass there. That, you know, it's tough with the black walnuts there. The squirrels are going to want to dig in that yard. I don't know about the fungus situation. The timing on that would be weird to have a fungus. So, but I would look at seeding like a bluegrass and fine fescue mix. That would be a durable mixture of grasses that would perform well.
All right. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We've got a couple of phone lines open for you right now, and Teresa is on the line in Stewart. Hello, Teresa.
Hi. I have a question about something that I either saw or heard, that if you put a mixture of salt and water in a spray bottle and go around and spray your grass, that will virtually eliminate fleas and ticks for the summer. I'm wondering if that is true, and also wondering if it is true, how harmful would that be to other insects, like burrowing insects or hibernating insects?
Adam?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm afraid that's a myth to my knowledge. I don't know why the saltwater mixture would keep fleas and ticks away for a long time. It would do a lot of damage to the plants on the top of the ground as well. You know, when you look out there at areas next to sidewalks, things like that, there's a lot of salt damage there already. So I wouldn't do that.
Right. That's enemies used to salt the earth before vacating defeated territory, right? Because then nothing could grow. Oh, there are a lot of methods that get passed around online. Here's another question. This one's from Nathan. My family's moving from Ankeny to Iowa City. The housing market has meant that we were able to sell our house in Ankeny before finding one in Iowa City, while I was able to reconcile myself to abandoning the 3 apple trees I planted. We are able to divide some rhubarb and raspberry canes that we got from our dear friends. At any point before April 30th, our temporary housing situation in Iowa City means that we currently have no ground to put those plants in. Is there any way to keep them alive until such a time as we have a more permanent place to put them?
Yeah, you can dig up and you can kind of divide these because they should be up. It's going to mess up the timing of harvest a little bit, but put them in a large container. Just containerize these plants for a while until you can actually plant them into the ground. So do a really good job of digging up a nice clump or a nice piece. Put it in with some soil and some potting soil in this container so that it can be held there for in a container for a couple of months. And then, of course, take it with you. And then I would put it in like a partially shaded situation and water as needed. And I probably would say not to harvest at this particular time. So you're gonna replant it and probably take a couple of years before it reestablishes and is ready for harvest.
All right, 866-780-9100 is the number to call. 866-780-9100. Don is on the line in Anamosa. Hi, Don.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I've got a problem with moles in my yard, and I was under the impression that if you was to spread, like, grub X to get rid of the grub worms to help control that it would help control the moles as well. And if it is, when would be a good time to spread that?
Yep. So that's a good question, Don. Get this a lot. Actually, moles don't just eat grubs. And so that's kind of an urban myth as well. And so that would not be a solution to the moles as far as that goes.
All right. So Mythbusters edition of Horticulture
right.
Day today.
Great.
So Don, do you want to be, what are you seeing on your lawn that is a problem? Maybe Adam can help with a different solution.
Well, you know, I'm, like I said, I mean, I can see the molehills, and I've used the mothballs, I've used the little sprayer deals that you light and fog them out. I've tried just about everything, the little peanuts and stuff, and mm-hmm. they just continue to come back year after year.
Yeah, this is a really tough one, and it's a tough one for the homeowner because moles can do a lot of damage to that turf. So I guess we just recommend if there's any runs, we just kind of put it back down, water the area so it kind of reestablishes a root system. And then if it's probably just one mole or vole that's doing all this damage, and unfortunately, probably the best way to eliminate that is some sort of trap. And they're not friendly traps on this particular case. And not always easy to put in and be effective either. So I don't know that I have any good answers. Adam, I don't know if you have any good answers. This is a tough one. So we're myth busting, but we're not providing any positive
yeah.
feedback.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
Sorry.
Don, thanks a lot for the call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Cheryl's on the line next in Clear Lake. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
We have 2 mature hackberry trees in our front yard, and every fall and every spring they're full of robins. Which we love, but the last 2 years, the hackberries have not produced any berries at all. And I didn't know if that was a sign of decline for the trees or condition of the weather or what.
Yeah, it's not necessarily a sign of decline of the trees. Some trees do have this tendency to kind of go through this alternate bearing cycle. So they produce a lot of fruit 1 year and then very little the next. I think I would kind of think about the situation that it's in. So trees produce a lot of fruit in signs of stress or regularly produce fruit when things are going well. So maybe you want to make sure that, you know, there's not been any construction damage in that particular area that might impact it, or if it was super dry, maybe watering it once or twice a month. If it's a well-established tree, it's probably okay. I wouldn't worry too much. The robins are still going to visit. Hopefully you have some other plants in your yard too, that they're getting some food from. Hackberry's an incredible tree.
I do, but I always look forward to the spring when they would come, you know, because that was the first sign that the trees were alive with berries and robins. But
And
so you're telling me just to be patient.
Yeah, just be patient. It's a really tough tree. And you'll know if it's in decline, because it's a tree that part of it will die and not come back. So I wouldn't.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you'll see some signs of life in the next month, and hopefully some robins too.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call, Cheryl. Next up, Don in Quasqueton. Hi, Don.
Hello.
Or Dean. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I transplanted some wild black raspberries a couple, 3 years ago. I've been training them on a trellis to keep the ends of the plant from going down to the ground and spreading farther. I'm wondering about trimming them canes off to contain them a little better.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, no, you can. With black raspberries, we often kind of prune them 2 or 3 times a year. To kind of keep them as productive as possible. And even though they're wild black raspberries, you do want to kind of contain them. And you can do a little, during the dormant season, you can do a little thinning, pruning of those old canes that maybe aren't going to be productive or that are dead. You might see some of that, and it's a good time to do that now. And then in another month or so at spring, when it kind of creates this new growth, sometimes with black raspberries we'll do another little tip pruning to encourage them to branch a little bit more and to fill in, and that's where they typically flower and fruit, so you kind of increase fruit production that way as well. And then you can do a little bit of pruning too at the end of the season after they're done, once again to remove those canes that are going to die, because they're kind of biennial. A lot of those canes. So there's a publication on this. I know that's a lot to kind of say over the radio, but if you go to an extension office or go online to ISU Extension, there is a Pruning Raspberries publication that explains all this and also kind of has some illustrations as well that might help.
So I can go out there now, whack them off about 1 foot tall, take off everything I've let grow on the trellis. Once it gets growing again, nip the tops of them off, and they'll branch out more and contain themselves better.
That's the hope. That's the hope. There are black raspberries, so they're gonna be pretty vigorous, and that's what you want as well.
Dean, thanks a lot for the call. 866-780-9100 is the number. Mike asks, he says he heard us talk about Dutch white clover as a plant for a bee-friendly lawn, but he wants to know, Adam, if there are any native species that would achieve the same results.
I am not aware of a true native species.
I don't know. There's got to be some native clovers that might do. And I know I've seen sometimes on the bee lawns some violets, but that's usually more in the shade. The other ones that Minnesota's promoting are the kind of self-heal and the thyme, and neither one of those are native either. So.
Well, and so correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the reasons that the clover is recommended for lawns is because you still want that expanse of low-growing green plants that you can move through. And so, I mean, like native prairies are great for pollinators, but they're not necessarily great for a lawn that you want to spend time on, right?
Right.
Yeah, and the clover and some of the other things, they can hold their place, but they're not going to outcompete the lawn either. So it's a nice kind of symbiotic relationship, because it stays nice and low, and they can still tolerate it. Yeah,
and so they bloom a long time. So that's
for the pollinator. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, and Nick has another question for you, Adam. How do you feel about applying gypsum to lawn turf?
So you're gonna, want to look at why you're doing it, I guess.
What is it for?
So gypsum a lot of times is applied as a application to remove salts from a soil. And so you'd want to see if you had a salty soil issues there. There's, you know, most Iowa soils don't really have a need for gypsum applications.
All right. We were just talking earlier about maybe salt damage next to a road or something like that. Is that an application?
Yeah, you could look at it there. I would do a soil test first to see if that's truly the issue. A lot of times the salt damage is just surface there.
All right. So I'm going to read into your tone and say you don't feel great about applying gypsum to lawn turf.
I wouldn't be applying it. No, not tons, for sure.
All right. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa with me, Cindy Haynes, professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, Adam Tomes, assistant professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. He's also a turf grass specialist. And you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about your lawn, garden, houseplants, any of the things you grow. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today is Horticulture Day, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Adam Tomes, assistant professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, and Cindy Haynes, professor of horticulture at ISU. And let's get back to the phones. Michelle is on the line in Marion. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. So I have lilac bushes in my backyard, and they were severely damaged during the derecho. Mm-hmm. And I really haven't gotten much flower off of them since then. They're very, very tall. They're like 7-8 feet tall. I'm wondering, I heard, I think, on the show last year about cutting them back and maybe, you know, just letting them kind of repopulate and get mm-hmm. thicker over time. I don't know when to do that, though. Is this a good time to think about that before they start developing?
Right. So now is a pretty good time to prune back lilacs. I might mention something called renewal pruning, which is a way to kind of rejuvenate them over 2 or 3 years of time. So you can go out now, and this would be a great weekend to do it. And take about a third of the stems, the biggest stems, and just cut them back to the ground. And what that will do is encourage a 2 or 3 new stems to kind of come from the base of the plant. You'll still have some older stems there, but those older lilacs bloom on old growth. So if there's any blooms there, they're going to bloom this year, and you'll still have some of that. So you do this every year, taking a third of the stems back to the ground for 2 or 3 years. And then after that time, then after 3 years, you have a kind of a rejuvenated, renewed the whole lilac. And it's a little shorter. It has stems that are a couple of years old that are still blooming. So you're never really totally losing blooms. You maybe have a little bit less blooms. And then at the end of it, the lilac comes out in much better shape. Once again, lilacs are pretty tough. If it's an established lilac, it's got a good root system, and it's a great way to kind of control it and kind of have that beautiful lilac that you remember in just a couple of years.
Michelle, thanks a lot for the call. I cannot wait for lilacs to bloom.
I know.
It's
Me
coming.
Too.
It's so close. All right, next up, Zachary's on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Zachary.
Hi, Charity. Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One of the earlier callers had asked about gypsum, and I wanted to see if the panelists had any experience with biochar. I had attended the Shade Tree Short Course in Iowa State about a month ago. Kudos to Dr. Iles for his program there. It was great. And one of the presenters had talked about adding biochar to new plantings, and it's just something I'm not familiar with. So I wanted to see if the panelists had any experience with that.
Yeah, thanks, Zachary. So first, would somebody define biochar for us so we know what we're talking about?
So biochar, it looks like charcoal, really fine ground charcoal. It's a slightly different process than charcoal. So you can't just crumble up charcoal and put it in your garden beds. But it's been used for centuries as something to kind of improve poor soils. So I think they're in other parts of the world. I don't know that Iowa is one of them. There's a lot of research on biochar at Iowa State, and it's especially as a kind of a byproduct of the ethanol process. So there's another caveat there. I've seen some research on using biochar in maybe some vegetable gardens that have fairly poor soils, and there is some potential benefits there. Maybe even using biochar as a media mix in potting soils, that there might be some advantages there. There's still a lot of research to be done. On the lawn, anything, Adam?
Yeah, biochar has been used as an additive in some turf situations to mixed results.
Mm-hmm.
It can be expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you have a good compost source available, a lot of times that provides a lot of the benefits that biochar does at a much cheaper cost, plus you're being able to use up the compost. So,
I think this may be something we see more in the future, and then maybe there's some more research that kind of comes with it. And it might be like most of these things, it works really well for certain situations in certain soils, like poor soils, which Iowa doesn't always have a lot of. So we might see this one. It sounds like Zachary's just a little bit ahead of the time, so maybe
an early adopter.
Early adopter, another 5 years, maybe we'll know more.
All right, Zachary, thanks a lot for the call. Next up, Blake in Hiawatha. Hi, Blake.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm asking about Creeping Charlie. What is the best, from a big box store, per se, that you could hook up a garden hose to?
All right, Creeping Charlie or ground ivy, one of our favorite questions of all time, right, Adam?
Yeah, it's the most common question I get. So Creeping Charlie is very, very hard to remove from a yard. When you go to a big box store and you're going to look for a herbicide to take it out, you're going to look for the product that contains the most triclopyr on the label. So the highest rate of triclopyr possible is the best product to do that. The other thing is you should address is the fact that Creeping Charlie is there because it's a heavy shaded area. And so it's creating conditions where the Creeping Charlie can outcompete the turf. So maybe try to cut some limbs up, and that'll help too.
All right. And if you don't want to use chemicals on ground ivy, it's a really long, strenuous process to get rid of it, right?
It is. It's super long. It's a struggle there. You could apply things like high rates of iron, salt water, smother it with black plastic. Those are all options there.
All right. It's a hard one. It does flower early, which is how I try to make myself feel better about it. But I know Richard Geron was on this show for many years and pointed out that it also outcompetes native plants in shady areas. So it's a tricky one. Let's move on to this question, which is a lot easier. Johnny wants to know, when is the best time to plant natives and pollinators, and any advice for best practices for planting those in a backyard?
Yeah, so natives and pollinators, pollinator plants, it really depends on what you want to plant. So some natives like woodland wildflowers, they're usually spring blooming, so you're going to try and find those as nursery grown plants and plant them in the spring. Some of those go dormant, so some of them are ephemeral. Prairie plants, once again, you can get those as container plants, maybe. At a local garden center, you can also sometimes get some seed of some of those. The timing of planting, once again, depends on how you've you know, gotten the plant. Container plants can be planted anytime from spring through fall. Seed of prairie plants are usually sown sometime in late summer or fall, because sometimes they need a kind of an overwintering period. Other native plants you should look for are trees and shrubs. There's lots of those at local garden centers as well. So just look for that label, which often tells you, or ask that employee at the garden center what's native, because those are usually on display. And spring is a great time to plant many of these plants.
All right, Johnny, thanks for the question. Deanna from Fairfield says, last fall there was a lot of talk about leaving dead plant material as the host for various insects over the winter. If you did this, when is it safe to do spring cleanup and remove last year's growth?
Now is a pretty good time to start doing some of that spring cleanup. I know in my garden, I want to kind of get some of that, the old debris off before the kind of new growth emerges on some of those perennial plantings. So I'm going to cut back some of those grasses before the kind of new grass emerge. And usually late March, early April is a good time to do those kinds of things.
Marilyn says, I have a row of dead ash trees that have the tops removed. They are about 15-foot tall stumps now, and I would like to plant native vines at the base to provide habitat and beauty. I'm thinking about native bittersweet. Is that a good idea? What are my other options?
Oh, native vines. So I keep thinking of native vines. There are a few. The ones I keep thinking about are like Virginia creeper would do this and do this really well, but it's not necessarily a blooming vine. The American bittersweet is one, but you really want to make sure you get the American, not the Oriental.
Because the American is native, the Oriental bittersweet is invasive, right?
Right. The Oriental is much more aggressive and invasive. I'm trying to think of some other vines. I would avoid things like a trumpet creeper because that might be a little too aggressive and would outcompete some other vines. I would also think about some, at least some temporary vines maybe that could get started to kind of grow up to establish. And that might be some things like perennial vines, like even clematis, which isn't necessarily a native, but it will be pretty and provide some nice flowers. At least in the spring or the summer.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Martha's on the line in Jefferson County. Hi, Martha.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I have a question about a very small orchard. I bought a house that has maybe a half a dozen various fruit trees, and I have no idea where to even start. Complete beginner. So I was wondering if you had any book recommendations, website recommendations. I get a little overwhelmed even on like the extension website because I know nothing. So right. Any tips or recommendations?
Right. And you're right. We have some nice resources or publications on fruits and growing fruits. Some of them are bigger. Some of them are a little bit smaller. When you think about an orchard, though, think about the fact that, you know, we want to maximize the flower so then that flower is producing the fruit that you want in the summer or fall with like apples or plums or cherries.
Right.
So usually this means that there's plenty of trees for cross-pollination because some of them really like that. Usually this means sometime in the dormant season we do a little bit of pruning on the trees to allow a little more light in. So we have higher yields and what's left is a little bit bigger. So pruning will be one of your maintenance tasks. Sometimes, especially in kind of wet springs and wet summers, there might be some spray applications, some fungicide applications to prevent certain diseases as well. So those are the things that we kind of look for right now is information on, you know, pruning and information on potentially spraying if you need to do that. And then just kind of go through a couple of cycles and kind of read these publications as you're kind of looking through and getting that information. And you'll become more comfortable and more familiar with it over time.
As far
it doesn't
as
have to be stressful.
Pollinating. It does not seem stressful. As far as cross-pollinating, I think there's two of each species. Does that seem like that would be enough for most fruit trees?
Yeah, it is. It depends on the fruit trees. Okay. The pie cherries or the tart cherries only need one. But the plums and the pears and the apples, we usually like a couple of different cultivars of each that are blooming at the same time. And then we make the bees do all the work. So, and they usually do a really good job. So, and sometimes, you know, even if your neighbor has something different, that might help as well. So I don't think you need to plant anything else. I think you just need to kind of learn how to grow what you've got. And that'll come with a little bit of experience and a little bit of time.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. And good luck, Martha. You got quite a laugh, or it doesn't have to be stressful. Roger's up next in Algona. Hi, Roger.
Yeah. Hi. I was just had a question. My daughter's got a dog, and what's the best thing to put on your yard to help with the dog urine from killing the grass?
Yep. That's, good question. Really, there's not a lot you can do. Try to get the dog to move around and try to have it not use the same spot over and over again. That helps. A lot of reseeding, watering back into those spots, especially where they've used it all winter over and over again, is going to be key. That's what helps a lot.
Can you follow the dog around and then just have a bucket of water so after they pee, then you just kind of leach it out?
Yeah, right.
I don't know. Would that work?
That would help.
Okay.
Definitely.
And
I mean,
a fun hobby.
And exactly. A fun hobby. You're watering the lawn at the same time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, Adam.
Roger, thanks for the call. Good problem solving, Cindy.
Okay, sorry.
Last call of the day. Joe's on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good morning.
What's your question?
Oh, yes. I am interested in cover crop / green manure. I'd like to know about what to use and when. My story is I use wheat straw for mulch last June, and I usually use, you know, rice straw, whatever my store has, but I use the wheat straw, and it rained really hard for a few weeks, and I had a wheat crop. And I thought, I overtook all my garden plants, and I know it's good stuff, but I tried to pull it up. I pulled up some, but anyway, I know it's good to plant like some type of seed, but I want to know what and when, because I didn't do the right thing there, and I didn't know there were so many seeds in it.
All right. Well, Joe, we've only got a minute for this, so I probably shouldn't have set you up for such a complicated question right at the end of the hour. But Cindy, a stab.
Well, yeah, there are some resources on the Horticulture and Home Pest News. So go there to kind of get some information. And I will tell you that there's more than wheat that you can do. There's some brassicas that might be possible. There's even annual ryegrass might be something you could do temporarily. For a little time. So it's access to the seed, finding the seed in the quantity that you need, and then timing it for when you want it to grow and when you want it to terminate. So that's the other things to consider. You have other options. Just check out some of those options maybe at Horticulture and Home Pest News. And did I do that in a minute?
You did. Good job.
Yes.
And I'll even
okay.
squeeze in this question from Pat. Is it okay to transplant snowball bush right now?
It's going to bloom soon. So if I would do it, I would do it very quickly and water well and expect it not to bloom as well this spring.
All right. Cindy Haynes, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Cindy Haynes, professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. Adam Tomes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Adam Tomes, assistant professor of horticulture at ISU and turf grass specialist. We'll be back again with Horticulture Day next Friday on Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Don't go in.